I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. When you hear somebody singing high praises of solitude in nature or in the wilderness, it's probably wise to remember that solitude can also mean isolation. For super gregarious people, being all alone in the wild might be excruciating, but for others, a dream come true. Where do you fit in? Our next guest on Constant Wonder knows the benefits of life in society, but also the benefits of solitude, that beautiful experience I'm talking about, beautiful for many people. And she has a story to tell about making not just a friend, but a best friend with a fox. Catherine Raven has been a ranger at 5 different national parks in the western United States, in the Pacific Northwest, and in Minnesota. Earning a PhD in biology is a very important fact of who she is, but so is the schooling that comes from befriending a fox, which she has written about in her memoir, Fox and I, An Uncommon Friendship. She's on the line. Catherine Raven, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Oh, thank you. You are very welcome to my time. I'm happy to be here.
Catherine, just as an icebreaker here, if it were possible to measure percentages of a personality, what would you say today about how much of a people person you are today, where you are in life right now?
I think that I have stopped dividing up individuals by their species quite a bit. In the morning when I get up and go outside, I say to myself, I got to check on who's here and who's doing what. And I go check on the badger and the skunk and looking for tracks and see what trouble the deer have made overnight and even the plants. And I just refer to everything as a who, but I definitely spend a lot more time with people because they're individuals. And I think I'm actually an extrovert, can you believe it? Because I'm so interested in other individuals besides myself. Last week, I was in Yellowstone Park with about 20 other people, and I was so happy, and they were terrific, and they made me laugh a lot, and it was great to share so many experiences with so many funny, wonderful people.
Yeah, and that's the question, as I put it to you, is where are you today? This extroverted aspect of your personality, is that a relatively new thing? Was it a thing you had to learn and develop?
Yes, I learned it and developed it from copying that fox, I think. But there was a time before I met him when I didn't really want to talk to anyone and had trouble talking and didn't think anybody wanted to listen to me. I just kept hearing voices saying, shut up, shut up, shut up, if I tried to talk. And I didn't like to talk. And I was hiding away. And the fox, he was so outgoing. He went out of his way to make a friend with a person. I think he knew it's not a great idea to live by yourself. And he wasn't just friends with me. He was hanging out with magpies. He hung out with other foxes. He was very social. And I realized it took a while. It took more than 2 years that I wanted to be him. I wanted that personality. And it turns out that being an extrovert, caring more about other people and wanting to talk to other people and listen to other people and share conversations with them is really terrifically amazing for me. And it's what's natural for me. And yet the first time I had to give a talk to students, my goodness, it was 1999, I think, I started to cry. And my major professor said it was stage fright. And he wouldn't let me out of the room. He blocked the door, and I had to give my very first lecture crying. That's how scared I was to talk to other people. So it's been a long journey to get to where I am, and I thank the fox, of course, for that.
Well, we're going to talk more about what that friendship with a fox was like in a bit. I'm still very interested in where you came from before meeting the fox. And so give us a little bit of a timeline about deciding you would go into the life sciences, eventually working for the Park Service, I guess, getting the PhD. How did that all play out?
I think I have always been a person who loved animals and nature by my idea of nature, it meant places where there weren't people, isolated places away from people. And that's what drew me into the Park Service, getting away from people and having some privacy and not having anybody really know you or need to talk to you. And the skills that you needed in the Park Service were difficult but interesting things, and things that I was able to do: fire training, wildland fire training, law enforcement training, emergency medical training. And I started in the Park Service before I finished my bachelor's degree. I started as a volunteer, then a student conservation assistant, even though I wasn't really a student. They took me on that way at Glacier. I think this is something that you can't really change about yourself. I think if you're a city mouse or a country mouse, maybe that's not something that you inherit, but that's your DNA. I'm not sure if you have a science background. People always think that DNA is what you inherit, but you realize that most of my DNA is the same as a chimpanzee. I mean, virtually all of it. So your DNA is, because we're humans, it's a mix, and it's just what you get. So some people are going to understand, if you take the time to really think about it, you'll understand that you're a beach person, a mountain person, a country person, a city person. This is really a lot of what I understood from my relationship with the fox. People have a certain habitat that's their optimum habitat, and maybe it will take you all your life to figure out what that is. I hope not. But the point is, you might be born in a place that's not your optimum habitat, and maybe you're a surfer at heart, but you were born up in the mountains. All people, like all animals and all plants, have an optimum habitat. And I think my optimum habitat, of course, is living a little bit closer to nature and a little bit further away from the noise and commotion of cities. So even though I do love people, I also love a lot of the things that people tend to get rid of when they move into an area in a high concentration: other animals and quiet time.
Yeah. Do you like to be alone with your own thoughts?
I'm not very introverted. I don't like thinking about just things that don't make, I don't just think about things or worry. And I do like to write, of course, and I love to read. I love to work in the garden, and so that's something that's really a country kind of thing to do, and you really don't have space in a city to do that. But I will say that I can go long periods of time without talking to other people. I think this month I went once to the city because I did a reading, and then that's it so far, and I'm heading to Yellowstone in a few days. I may not get back to the city again the month of August. And when I was there, it was just for a reading. So I got there in the evening, did my book reading, and came home.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead, and if you would introduce us to the fox and tell us how you first struck up an acquaintance. So did he approach you, or did you approach him? Or was it a he to begin with?
It was a he. And he really dogged me around. I was trying to ditch him. And there were other animals here that I was more interested in because they seemed smaller, like voles. It didn't seem like maybe a fox was a great idea. And it just didn't dawn on me that we would become friends. The first time that he became very close to me, that he really made himself known, I had been seeing him on and off. He'd been on my property a lot, was when I thought I heard a knock on my door. In fact, I'm sure I heard a knock on my door, just knock, knock. But of course, I don't have a doorbell. And when I opened the door, I realized it really couldn't have been anybody at my door. I have a long driveway, and it's gravel, and it's very noisy. And I had been next to the door when it knocked, and I didn't hear anybody coming down the driveway. And when I opened the door, Fox was there, and he was a few meters away, not close enough to have reached out and knocked. It was just barely raining, just drizzling a little bit. He was soaking wet, and he looked down the driveway, and then he looked at me, and he looked down the driveway again. I had the impression that he was trying to tell me that somebody had knocked on my door and had fled down the driveway. And I think he was tricking me, actually. I went and walked all the way around the house, and there wasn't anybody around anywhere. It was just the fox. Later on, many months later, when I got to know him, I realized he had a habit of taking a rock and pushing it against the door, and he would make that knock knock. He would do it twice, and it would make that sound. It was like this brownie shaped rock that was next to the front door, and he would knock it, and I would hear that. And that must have been what he did that night, and then walked away. So he was kind of a tricky little guy, and I didn't figure that out that night, and I couldn't figure out what a soaking wet fox was doing. But being so tiny and being so soaking wet when it's hardly raining kind of made me feel sorry for him. Later on, when I really got to a point where there was no going back, that I knew we were going to be friends, was when we locked eyes. So seldom that you really make eye contact with another individual, really just stare into another individual's eyes and have them stare back. And that happened with Fox when I had a big fly on a scab, a big house fly. It was playing with a scab on my knee, and I was trying to get it off my knee. And then finally I gave up and just started watching the fly because he was so interesting. Plus, he wasn't going to leave my knee anyway. I mean, he would for a minute or two. He'd just come right back again. So I was watching this huge house fly play in the scab with this wet blood on my knee. And I looked up and this fox was there, maybe 2 meters away and coming closer and not even looking at me at all, as if he didn't even know that a person was there. His eyes were just right on that big house fly. That's just all he was staring at. And I said, "Fox." And that was pretty instinctive, not to shout or to yell, but just to say it in a whisper. He could probably tell as he got closer from my heartbeat that I wasn't scared, that it wasn't beating fast, that I wasn't upset, wasn't making any sharp moves. And he put his nose down. When he did that, his snout was out of the way of my vision so that we were absolutely eye to eye, our eyes being almost the exact same width apart. Consider how different our sizes are, and yet our eyes were almost this, are they really almost the same width apart? And we're the same height from the ground. And we were just frozen there, eye to eye, that close. And then I just said, "Fox, fox." And he stayed. And I stayed. And at that point, I didn't realize it till afterwards, but there was really no going back from that point on. It's just so rare to have that kind of a moment with someone. You just can't go back. And that amount of trust that he was that close, he could have injured me, I could have injured him, and we trusted each other that much.
This is not a normal experience for most humans. Now, you're trained to be a ranger. You've spent those years in those national parks. And I know that the messaging from the National Park Service has to do with giving animals their space and not feeding them and not doing anything that would tend towards domestication. How did you navigate that with this animal?
Well, that was really difficult. Between the science and between the paradigms that we learn in the Park Service, the idea that we shouldn't anthropomorphize, that's sort of a nasty, big, bad word. And it's something that's really discouraged. And it's not just discouraged by the paradigm. It's almost discouraged in the sense that it's what divides a child from an adult. And children can read books and think about animals as having some human characteristics, but you're supposed to get to be an adult and stop thinking that way and start treating animals as though they're extremely different than we are. Afterwards, after I realized that our ideas of anthropomorphism are things that really need to be changed, that aren't quite acceptable to me, because we can't say, let's not give foxes human characteristics when, in fact, we really don't know what human characteristics are. We really don't know which characteristics humans have, which personality traits only belong to humans and which ones we share with other animals. We don't know that. So it's kind of doesn't make much sense to say we're being anthropomorphic when I say that I think the fox was being a little tricky, a little sneaky when he was looking down the driveway and then looking at me. And the other thing that I realized about national parks is that they are so unique. We can't possibly take the behavior that we have to practice in a national park and practice the same behavior when we're on private land. National parks are what they are because they're extremely special. They're gems. Glacier Park, the gem of the continent. They really are absolutely jewels. They are such rare places, so incredibly important, and so overcrowded. So what happens inside a national park, that really has to be the bailiwick of that superintendent. One person has got to call the shots and be responsible for all of those animals and say, this is what we're going to do inside a national park. And I think that can be confusing. It was confusing for me since I spent so much time in the parks, but a National Park Service policy, how you treat an elk or a fox in Yellowstone Park is not going to be the same way that you treat an individual fox or elk or deer or skunk on your own private property, because my private property doesn't have 2 million visitors a year stomping up and down.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I'm wondering at this point then, and I know this is an overused word, and it's kind of metaphoric here, but the idea that your relationship with Fox, as it developed, was it sort of an organic thing that you didn't think too much about, or did you try to set boundaries in your relationship? Did you think it through, or did you just kind of let it wash over you?
I did not think it. I thought in the beginning, and thinking just confused me. And one of the very important lessons I learned from the fox is not just that fox is very much like me, but that I need to be more like fox. And that means less time stressing over ridiculous theories, thinking about things that shouldn't be thought about, and just letting your gut feeling, your instinct, because human instinct, human nature, it's been evolving for a couple hundred thousand years. And sometimes our instinct is just terrific. And when you think about science, well, science is more than terrific, but it's narrow. It's a very sure science is the brightest light we can shed on any problem. But it's a pretty narrow light. That's why it's so bright. It can't answer a whole bunch of different questions. I mean, it can't tell us if there's a God. It can't tell us if you're in love with someone. It can't really tell you if Fox has a personality and what you should do. The should questions usually aren't questions that science can answer. So science, it can give us vaccines and tell us when we should take a vaccine. It can put us on the moon. It can cure cancer. But it can't do everything. And you have to also get back to your gut feeling, your instinct, your human nature. And so when I let it develop organically, as you said, just go with the flow, as people would say, just let your feelings guide you, I came to the right place and realized this relationship is fantastic. This is absolutely the right relationship for me. And if I feel like an idea makes it wrong, then I'm thinking too much about it. Then the idea is wrong.
Catherine Raven is with us. We're talking about her book, Fox and I, An Uncommon Friendship. We're going to talk about, was there anything common in this friendship? After a short break here on Constant Wonder, stay with us. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. It's a delight to have Catherine Raven with us. We're talking about her memoir titled Fox and I, An Uncommon Friendship. Kathy, just before the break, I was wondering if there was anything that was normal, common, or did the relationship normalize and become so comfortable between the two of you that it was just a given?
It was just a given. It just moved very rapidly. And it was just a given, and it became very normal, even though if you looked at us from afar, you would say, that's very strange. This should not be happening. But it just seemed completely normal. We saw each other every day, and we certainly spent more time together, I think, than a lot of married couples do with each other in the same amount of time. We knew each other better than a lot of other folks who are in relationships know each other. I would say that for sure. And we cared about each other a lot. Everything just seemed very normal to have another individual in your life that you care about.
Now, there was something very interesting about the routine of Fox coming by, I guess, every afternoon around 4:15. Was it really almost clockwork?
Yes, in the beginning. And then after we went through several years. So we were together in the winter time then. And of course, some days in the winter, he wouldn't come by if it was very, very windy. He did not like a lot of wind. But in the beginning, yes, if it wasn't regular, we would not have established a relationship. You have to have an animal that's diurnal. First of all, that was unusual about him, that he was so attracted to the daylight. And most animals, and certainly most foxes and most of the wild animals on my property, are most active in the dark. And he was active mostly in the daytime, so that made a difference. But if he wasn't regular, it would have been impossible to start a relationship because you can't just be outside 24 hours a day waiting. I'm sure that he had his time set by the sun. After so many days and so many months of following him around, looking at what he's looking at from the same height, feeling what he's feeling, smelling what he's smelling, I can see that the sun meant a lot to him. So he wanted to be where his little body was warm, but he didn't want the sun in his eyes. And he had to have this patch of ground. He waited until the heat of the day starts around 3. Things start heating between 4 and 6. The ground's going to be the hottest. He wanted the ground to be warm, but he had to wait until the sun, just in that spot that he wanted, just when the sun drops behind this hill on the west, so that the sun wouldn't be in his eyes. That's what he was waiting for. He had, I think, everything was timed for the sun.
Did he have any expectations of you that you were able to detect?
Oh, yes. I think his expectation was that I was a large mammal around here that could help him out quite a bit. I think he noticed, he certainly notices that humans have hands, that I have hands. I'm not sure if any other humans he might have seen, but I have hands, and he could see how helpful that was. And I was doing some weeding to get the weeds out of his vole patch so that he could have better access to his number one food source, which was voles. That was definitely something. He expected me to do the gardening for him, get rid of the thorny weeds, the woody ones, the dense ones that were in his way, and even to move a little cactus out of his way one time. that was my job. And he also expected me to protect him from feral cats. He really hated feral cats. And I don't blame him. I think they're the number one killer of kit foxes in my state. They're killers, as you know. And again, I'm saying feral. I'm not talking about people's kitty cats that are in their houses. These are cats that somebody has let loose and are living on their own and in the wild. He didn't like them, and he could tell that I didn't like them too. He could watch me throwing stones at cats and yelling, "Shoo!" So he certainly could tell that I wasn't going to tolerate having feral cats on my property. And he also noticed that I kept dogs away. Dogs aren't a big threat here. They're almost never off leash, but they had been off leash and they had chased the fox. So he knew that was my job. Watch the fox from the dogs, watch that the cat doesn't get him, and keep the weeds out of the way.
So all told, how long did this relationship last?
So all my relationship from when I first started seeing him to when I decided that we were gone, the kits and I and everything was needed to be, that it had come to an end, was almost 4 years. And that's a long time. But I think that readers know from the get-go, if you're reading a story, any story, if it's a true story about a wild animal, that the animal dies. Everybody knows that you pretty much write the story to because wild animals, unfortunately, don't have long lives. And so there is going to be a death, and that's how it will come to an end. And I'll also say that I dropped the ball. I kind of made a big mistake at the end. I tried to be a very good friend. I was learning my way through friendship and practicing how to be a good friend with the fox, but I made a big mistake and I wasn't a great friend. And I made a big mistake that cost, I think, the relationship to end. Mm. And there was a lot of, you know, there's fire around here, and that's always a threat to wildlife, of course.
You've said at various times elsewhere that this relationship with a fox somehow gave you a little bit of leverage in terms of human relationships. Am I right in that? That you kind of practiced?
Yes, you know what it – yes, it did two reasons. The first is that he was very social and I wanted to be like him. I didn't decide that until he was gone. And then I decided instead of missing him, but what I really wanted to do was just be more like him. And I realized one of the main ways we're different is that he really didn't like being alone. He was smarter than that and knew that wasn't a great way to live. So that pushed me out. But there was one more thing that's very important, and that is self-esteem. And he gave me a self-esteem, a purpose in life, which I think gives you self-esteem, but he just made me feel worthy. And that is pretty amazing. The fact that he cared about me so much, that he trusted me so much. One night he brought his four little kits down. I don't know if they were his biologically, but they were the ones that were in the den that he was living in. He brought these four little kits down, no other adult, just him and the four little ones. And he let me mind them while he just fell asleep or pretended to fall asleep nearby. And that is really a tremendous amount of trust. Plus all the time that he spent with me, it made me feel like I had some purpose in this world and something to offer. And it made me put on a little bit of a braver face when I was around people.
Hmm. Well, your book is expansive in that you don't just talk about the relationship with the fox. There's other animals that figure into your story. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about swans, because they're important to you as well.
Well, swans are really important to everybody in the United States and the West, I think. The swans that I talk about are the mute swans and the trumpeter swans. And mute swans are European swans. And trumpeters are native swans here that almost went extinct shortly after the last Great Depression, the one in the 1930s. And the reasons that they almost went extinct, one of the reasons is because the way they look, Americans weren't really keen on that. They thought they were a little bit homely compared to the mute swans, the European ones. And of course, they make a lot of noise. It's unpleasant. It doesn't sound like an actual trumpet. They're called trumpeters because they're loud, but not because they sound like a musical instrument. And mute swans don't make any noise, as you could probably figure. So a lot of ranchers and homeowners and people that manage public parks, they got rid of the native swans, moved the European swans in. And then the United States government came along finally only in recent times and got rid of the mute swans, purchased them. I'm not sure where they put them, and replaced them back with the native swans again. One of the things that I learned about anthropomorphism and animals came from bringing my students to the Museum of Wildlife Art. It has a pond in front of it, and there are trumpeter swans. One of the only places, well, shoot, you're Brigham Young University, so you should know, the only places where you can have trumpeters breeding in the United States of America is this little stretch of land around here, a little bit of Idaho, where Brigham Young has a branch, Wyoming and Montana. So just this little area is where they're breeding, and the Museum of Wildlife Art happens to be in that little area. We walked in and there was a painting. It looked to me like mute swans. They were beautiful and they had orange beaks. And I thought the painting was mislabeled trumpeter swans. So I was pretty arrogant about that, thinking that it was mislabeled. And when I told the artist, he was there doing a show out back, I pointed out that he had mislabeled his painting. I said, those aren't those aren't trumpeters in your painting. They're mute swans. And he said, no, those are trumpeter swans, but they're very vain and they're pretending to be mute swans. And everybody laughed except me. I was indignant. But looking back on that moment, I realized how right he was, that you absolutely have to have an imagination and creativity, and you have to understand the world that way, or you just miss so much. And of course, swans can be vain. When you paint something, you know, that museum had a bright purple coyote painting that was just fantastic. And you paint things the way the animals feel. You're painting their personalities. You're not trying to make it look like a photograph. I realize how important it is to have art in your life, which is imaginative. You need that imagination. And not having an imagination is really a serious personality flaw. It's not the difference between an artist and a biologist. Every career has to have an imagination. That's a necessary part of fitting in to the natural world.
I would also so enjoy hearing you talk about the Panther Creek fawn. This was one of those seminal moments, very important in your life story.
Yes. The Panther Creek incident happened at Mount Rainier National Park. And that was a sad, but yes, very important story. Now, the Park Service in those days had a policy that when an animal was injured, that was nature. And you just let nature take its course, as people are wont to say, which means that the animal's probably going to die. In this case, it was a fawn, and she had been injured, probably trying to escape dogs. We know there were dogs involved illegally in a campsite in a backcountry, not a managed site, but folks were just off trail, which was okay, but they had a dog, which was not okay. They seemed to have scared this fawn, and she had injured herself in a log jam. She was very injured, and she almost certainly wasn't going to live. And that was really hard for me. I thought that we should try to rescue the fawn, but I realized that this is the policy that we have, that when an animal is injured, it stays injured until it dies. And I thought back on all the animals that I had seen die in a national park. Mostly they're injured by other animals. Sometimes they're injured by cars, sometimes by dogs, but we tend to just say, this is no nature's sad. This is the way it is. I changed my mind about that. I felt that that's pretty arrogant for humans to feel like we have a right to watch other animals suffer and die, and that we almost enjoy that we feel like it's giving us a sense of nature. We're taking something at the expense of another animal's comfort. To watch another animal die just to make us feel like we're expanding our knowledge base, we're becoming tougher because we've watched something suffer. That seems very selfish to me, and that's not acceptable to me anymore. That's not something that I would allow to happen on my own property. And I also realized something else very important, and I think I've said it before in this talk. I realized the difference between thinking about something, using science and information, and going back to your gut instincts, your human nature. And I realized that saying that an animal should die in a national park because that's part of nature, that's a cultural decision. And our culture is a very brief moment of our time on this planet, but our human nature goes back hundreds of thousands of years. And I don't think that Homo sapiens have evolved to enjoy watching another animal suffer. I think that if I was in that same piece of land 100, 200 years earlier, before there were national parks, before there was settlement, and I was a person walking through the woods and saw an injured fawn, my human nature would tell me to try to save the fawn. Here's an animal, a large mammal, that has eyes that are a lot bigger than ours, that's very expressive when it looks at us. And we have trouble exchanging thoughts with worms and turtles and fish, perhaps, but a deer, not at all. I think that we definitely, we We understand when a deer is calling for help. We understand the distress in its voice. We understand the distress in its eyes. And I think our instinct would have been to help the animal. And that's a case where human culture is conflicting with human nature. I'm finding a lot of incidents like that in my own life, and I'm trying to get the culture out of the way when I come to a crossroads like that and I can't decide what to do, and lean more on my human nature, which has been evolving for so long.
So in that situation with that fawn, were you able to lean on your human nature? Did you intervene?
We did as much as we could. We had to wait till the chief scientist got out of the park. What I went by with my little Sierra cup dipped in water, and I tried to get her water, and I put little berries in my hand and tried to feed her. I brought blankets down for her to keep her warm. But in the end, she died, and that was just traumatic for me. I mean, that was just terribly sad. We were waiting. She's so light. We could have carried her out, but it's against park policy. So you have to be, again, I understand things have to be different on land that's owned by the Park Service, because that land belongs not to me or to even Washingtonians. It belongs to really every American. National park lands are public lands that belong to everyone. Supervising them is a huge responsibility. I know that. And those calls have to be made by a superintendent so that we just don't have some kind of really just confusing policies. And with so many, there's a lot of visitors that go to Mount Rainier. Yeah. There's a lot of visitors in most of our national parks today. So I understand things have to be different in national parks in the management. But it did make me realize that it's not tenable for me anymore to be in a place where it's okay to have animals suffer and die and people watching them suffer and die. And thinking, this is nature, this is so great, this is nature, this is what we're watching. Because it's not human nature to enjoy watching another advanced animal suffer.
So, Kathy, with your experience teaching students, with your experience visiting with people in national parks, given your training as a biologist, your PhD, what would you say is a way forward for us as we humans improve our own relationships with other animals?
Empathy is the most important thing, and we have to work on that. And the first thing we have to do is to stop generalizing. Science is really important to give us the general information, which means I'm assuming that everybody's taking biology classes in college. That's important, the science that gives you the general background, the generic fox. You need to understand that, but stop treating groups of animals as though they're one big homogenous group. Because when we just see a big group, then we can't empathize. You have to treat individuals as individuals. That's the first step in empathy. And that's really an important step. If I had my way, we wouldn't have dead animals all over the highways. And I do stop and move them out of the way when I can, if there's not a semi truck behind me and there's a safe place to pull over. I think that we get a little callous when we see animals just lying dead. So often we just get used to that as though it's normal. And I don't blame people for getting used to it and thinking it's normal, because I don't see them as animals, unfortunately. I can't. I've tried to make myself think that as I'm driving down the road and I see this deer and she's terribly injured and she's dying and she's been hit by a car, but I can't help myself. It just seems like a human to me. I just can't separate. I just can't see, oh, it's just a deer. And so it matters to me. But I think that everybody, so other people aren't ever going to think that. They're always going to think it's a deer. That's a fox on the side of the road. But I still think if we got to a place in our society where we stopped just getting so used to the fact that we could just let animals suffer, it would be a great way forward.
Catherine Raven with us. Her book is titled Fox and I, An Uncommon Friendship. Dogs, man's best friend, they say. Dogs are, of course, canines. Foxes are canines. Wolves, also canines. Why has humankind spent so much of its existence trying to exterminate the close cousins of our best friends? We're going to tackle that question coming up next here on Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Few creatures quite as charming as a fox, few quite as noble or inspiring as a wolf, or as clever and, I'm going to say it, as wily as the coyote. So it's kind of odd, don't you think, that humans view wild canines as threats to be exterminated. The qualities that we tend to hate so much in wild dogs, we actually love in our own animals. So I put a question to nature writer Cy Montgomery. Do we have a double standard when it comes to wild canines?
The wild dog that kind of got me into looking at this dichotomy between our beloved domestic dogs and the wild dogs was one that few people have ever heard of, and it's called the Dole. And it's a wild dog, red in color. It looks kind of like a giant fox. It lives in a number of places, but one of its strongholds is Thailand, where I went with a team from Earthwatch, the citizen science group that sends paying laymen to accompany scientists to do real science in projects around the world, in Khao Yai National Park. I was absolutely astonished to learn that these highly endangered, critically endangered dogs were, until very recently, just shot as if they were pests. Even in Khao Yai National Park, the previous park director to the one who is there now thought that they were so numerous that they should be hunted down and killed. And this absolutely astonished me. And it also astonished the conservation biologist who I was working with, Nguyen Song Sasson, who's the head of the Smithsonian Center for Species Survival. And she was one of two principal investigators on the project who are trying to find out about these mysterious dogs who whistle instead of bark and who can run 45 miles an hour, swim out after their prey and take it down, and leap 7 feet up in the air from a standstill. And no one knows about them.
Well, did you just say that you're in a national park where a species is endangered and was being killed off by the bureaucracy that runs the park?
They were suggesting that this be done. And these are extremely rare animals. There are maybe 2,000 breeding doles left on the entire planet, and that's fewer than the world's breeding tigers. And yet, in many areas, they're perceived as overabundant, and they are shot and poisoned and trapped, sometimes with government approval.
So what's at the root of this perception you're talking about? Why would we think that there's sort of a celebrity kind of an animal, a tiger or an elephant or a lion, the panda bear? Those are kind of celebrities. But there's no basis? There's just a perception that the dogs are expendable?
Yes, that is exactly so. And I found that wild dogs of all kinds have this terrible public relations problem. They're just persecuted with a passion that is not evident when, your water buffalo gets killed by a tiger. Nobody likes that, right? But man, if dogs, wild dogs, Cape hunting dogs, for example, in Africa, or wolves in North America, kill your sheep or goats, people go nuts. And this really shocked me, and it has also shocked people who have studied these wild dogs, because they know that most wild dogs are so like our domestic dogs that frequently they can even interbreed. So I was really interested in getting to the root of this. Why is it that wild dogs just ignite this terrible hatred and ire?
I have a hunch. I have a hunch you're going to explain it to us, but my hunch going into this conversation is that it all goes back to fairy tales from Europe about, you know, Red Riding Hood and dangerous animals in the forests.
Well, it might in our heritage, but how would that explain why dholes are so persecuted in Asia? And how would that explain why people so hate the beautiful so-called painted dogs or cape hunting dogs in Africa? So I think that our fairy tales reflect something even older and deeper about how we feel. Obviously not you and me, but how people feel about wild dogs versus tame dogs. And so what I did, I talked to some of my friends, one of whom is the animal behaviorist and zoologist Patricia McConnell. She's an advocate for gray wolf recovery in Wisconsin. And I talked with another friend of mine, a dear, dear friend of mine, who lives just 7 miles from our house, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, who's the author of The Secret Life of Dogs, and who had lived with dingoes and studied wolves. And we started to tease this thing apart. And we talked about how we feel about our own pet dogs. And as you know, there's a passion for loving our pet dogs here in America. I mean, we spend an incredible amount of money on our dogs, and we'll do anything to save them if they're sick. And most dog owners actually sleep in bed with their dogs. And I consider my dog a part of my family, and most people who own dogs do. But weirdly, sometimes those same people who love dogs will hate wolves, will hate coyotes. And why is that?
Well, maybe it all goes back to Old Yeller. I don't know.
Well, the answer that seemed to be arising was Patricia McConnell said to me, you know, it may be not in spite of our love for our pet dogs that we hate these wild dogs, but because of our love for our wild dogs, for our pet dogs, that we hate wild dogs.
Well, this is very counterintuitive, and it's going to take some explaining.
Yes, it sure is. Well, she says, look at wolves, look at coyotes, look at dholes, look at African painted wild dogs. They are so like our pet dogs. All the behaviors that we love in our pet dogs arose in their wild relatives.
What kinds of behaviors are you talking about there?
Mostly sociality. The fact that they're pack animals, that they are so devoted to the others in their group. Now, our dogs, we're their pack, and they show us that devotion. But wild dogs, they're devoted to their pack of conspecifics. They're devoted to their pack of fellow wild dogs. But when we look at those wild dogs, she says, you kind of see your own dog, but your dog does what you ask. Your dog comes when you call. And wild dogs are exactly the opposite. And she believes that maybe we get so infuriated with them, thinking, how can they be so like my dog, but not? And this may be why we just go so nuts.
Yeah, it's like we expect the wild at some point. I mean, this is just one of those big, broad brush things. But we humans expected the dog out there in the wild to heal and do what we say because it was so like the dogs that we resent the fact that these ones were, you know, the unruly adolescents who just disobey.
Who totally disobey. And what's so interesting is that the things that people say that they hate about wild dogs, that they loathe in wild dogs, they turn out to be the very same characteristics that we value in our pet dogs. They're almost virtually identical, but sometimes we just don't recognize it.
So when we hear about loyalty in a dog to a human, you're saying that it's not just that special dog-to-human relationship, but that's what dogs always come equipped with anyway because they're such social creatures that they were loyal to their own pack.
Exactly. But they figured out how to make us their pack mates. It's said that we didn't domesticate dogs. Dogs domesticated dogs. They are the ones who decided, gee, it would be great if I hung around these people. Now, of course, there's terrific benefits to us to have dogs. And to this day, people who hunt with dogs, who depend on hunting their food with dogs, there's been studies showing that they're far more effective hunters with dogs than without dogs. Dogs also, we use them to do other things other than hunt. They help us take care of sick and elderly people. They lead the blind. They provide us just with joy and happiness. But the reason they're able to do this is because they are the same social creatures. They have that same social drive that makes us despise wolves and dholes and cape hunting dogs and coyotes. But it's that social drive that makes us love our dogs. And here's another thing. This is why they have to be social, right? They have to be social because they will bring down prey that are much larger animals than themselves. Okay. Now a tiger, think of a tiger. A tiger might weigh 500 pounds and it can bring down a 700 pound sambar, but it can do it by a single bite to the neck. But a 30 pound dhole isn't able to do that. What they have to do is they have to use their social network. They have to use their whole group to bring that animal down. And when they bring that animal down, it's not pretty. They kill the animal essentially by eating it while it's alive. And they're able to do that because of their social network. Well, who does that remind you of? People. We too are able to bring down prey much larger than ourselves, but only because early on we discovered that we could work together. And it was even, we started working together to bring down prey even before we came up with sophisticated weapons like arrows. So we share with dogs this whole social system, and we share with dogs this proclivity to bring down prey larger than ourselves because we can activate our social network.
Cy Montgomery is a naturalist, an animal lover, author of many books about creatures. She's published about 30 books or so for adults and children, including The Soul of an Octopus and How to Be a Good Creature, a memoir in 13 animals. If you live way up in the frozen far north, your main objective might just be to get out of there, which is, of course, what Scandinavians did, many of them. Along the way, they colonized Russia, Britain, part of France, part of southern Italy, Iceland, Greenland, and very briefly, North America. Who were these Vikings? Why were there so many of them? The Viking story, coming up next after the news on Constant Wonder.